Hello and welcome to this week's What a Scream, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Egrain, chats with a special guest about horror films. And in particular, we talk about two films that have to do with a certain subject that I have previously randomly chosen. Now this week, our literary expert, Elaine Pascal, is back. And because it is a certain horror author's birthday month, we have decided to do two adaptations of his stories. I am, of course, talking about Stephen King. And it's amazing that it took this long for us to discuss Stephen King in our little literary adaptation series of podcasts. But here it is. So we are going to be talking about 2007's The Mist, which is directed by Frank Darabont. And then we are going to be talking about Gerald's Game from 2017, directed by Mike Flanagan. So enjoy this chat about some Stephen King adaptations.
So I would like to welcome back to the podcast. It's been a while, but she's back. It's Elaine Pascal. How are you?
I am fine, and I am thrilled to be back. It has been a little while. I've missed you.
Oh, I miss you too. How have you been? What have you been up to? What have you been reading?
Oh, I've been doing a lot. Been busy. In terms of what I've been reading, I always have a review pile, so things come to me more than I seek them out, but two that I've read lately that I've enjoyed. One was Rob Smale's Laundry Legs.
Okay.
Which it ties in nicely with one of the movies we're doing today, because right, it's half creature feature, half psychological.
Interesting.
The question that drives the narrative is, would you rather actually be seeing a monster? Or is it scarier to be seeing a monster, or is it scarier to be losing your mind to like dementia or something?
Okay. That is a very good point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I think I'd rather see the monster, but,
yeah, same.
The monster you can punch in the face and you can fight, but dementia you can't.
Exactly.
And then the other one that I read recently was Douglas Ford's The Trick, which begins with a magic trick where a tattoo is put on a man's hand and it ends up remaining. The trick is the tattoo, but the tattoo stays on his hand and there's some evil implications about the tattoo.
That sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it is an interesting one.
I'm going to have to check those out. I have not been reading. The last book I read was The Exorcist Legacy, 50 Years Later by Nat Segaloff. Because obviously it's the 50-year anniversary this year, so obviously consuming everything about The Exorcist recently. And that is an amazing book, actually, even for people like me who know, well, they think they know everything about The Exorcist. It's actually a really interesting book. So that's my literary recommendation.
Fantastic. I'll check it out.
Do. So this week's episode, I can't believe it took us this long, to be honest, to do this. But we are talking Stephen King adaptations. So tell me, what is your relationship like with Stephen King books?
Oh, I love Stephen King. I do. And I feel badly because a lot of people avoid him or feel like he gets too much attention. I think I told you I used to teach a Gothic lit class and we read Stephen King. And many of the students said, oh, I didn't think I would enjoy him because he's so popular, which doesn't really make sense. If you're popular, there might be a reason why you're popular. But I've always enjoyed him. I'm not saying I love every book of his. It's hit and miss. He's so prolific. He's so prolific. You can't love everything he does. Yeah. There's some that I love, some that I'm like, meh. But I do love him. I love his voice. I don't know when this will come out, but his birthday is the 21st. So happy birthday, Stephen King.
Happy birthday.
It was my dad's birthday as well. But no, a huge fan, and also a fan of many of the adaptations of his writings. I feel like often the people involved are very faithful to the source material, and they often do a really good job.
Yeah, I just feel like Stephen King is a lot of people's gateway into horror. I know I started reading him when I was a teenager. You know, I started with like Salem's Lot, with It, The Shining. And yeah, I mean, I just think, like, how can you not have read a Stephen King, or how can you even have not consumed some form of Stephen King? Like, you know, there's a reason he's like a master of horror. And like, I do know, like, a few people are like, well, his books seem to get a little bit silly, and you're like, yeah, I know, but he just seems to be able to tap into people's like base fears. And like, even when, you know, his book is about, say, a scary clown or a vampires, a lot of the actual horror in his book is very human based and is very society based. And yeah, I enjoy him as an author. I enjoy the adaptations. They're not always great. Like, I wouldn't say I was a massive fan of The Shining adaptation.
Oh, I do not like The Shining. Unpopular opinion, I do not like that film.
And I got very angry when Dr. Sleep came out, because it's not faithful to the book. And that really annoyed me. So yeah, but I think like you said, he's prolific enough that we're always going to have Stephen King adaptations. And also, without Stephen King, we wouldn't have people like Mike Flanagan.
Oh yeah. And think about how many characters and ideas he's developed that have become part of our culture. Like, we see a crazy dog, we're like, oh, Cujo, you know. We talk about It. There's so many things that he's given us that have become, we don't even realize that they came from Stephen King.
Yeah. 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 I mean, even if you think about The Simpsons, how many, like, you know, they've obviously taken, like, The Shining, Salem's Lot. And it's so ingrained in pop culture now. Like, even, like, people know, you know, Pig's Blood falling on, you know, girls at proms, and they probably don't realize that that's a Stephen King thing, or like Killer Cars, and they're like, oh, it's a Christine car. They don't realize that that's a Stephen King thing. And even like his stuff like Stand By Me, Shawshank Redemption, Green Mile, like, it's, I don't know, he's just so ingrained in our pop culture that, you know, it's kind of crazy, this whole phenomenon. And I like to think that, like, one of his first, or his first like major hit, Carrie, he threw the manuscript out, and it was his wife that went back and got it. Like,
yes, and she like, please give it one more try. Amazing, right?
Yeah. So really, we have his wife to thank for Stephen King's career. Okay. So let's kick off. Did you want to do your choice, which was, if you would like to introduce it?
I am doing The Mist, or Stephen King's The Mist.
Whoa! Mom, Dad, you gotta come see! The butter's so bashed, you just gotta... Come on! Whoa!
Having spoken, the doomsayer departs.
What? Why don't you get Billy dressed? I'll take him into town with him. Hit the store before it gets all bought out.
How'd you folks hold up in the storm?
Big insurance day.
Sorry to hear that.
What's going on?
It's death.
Something in the mist! Shut the doors! Shut the doors!
The only way we're gonna help ourselves is to seek rescue.
Tie this around your waist?
For four.
You let us know you got at least 300 feet.
There's nothing out there. Nothing in the mist.
What if you're wrong?
Then, I guess.
Which was released in 2007. It's based on a 1980 novella The film was written and directed by Frank Darabont, and Darabont had wanted to do an adaptation of The Mist since the 1980s. So, it took a while to get around to it. An interesting factoid is he wanted it to be in black and white, which I think would have been really cool to have that mist be this really thorough white. It stars my boyfriend Thomas Jane and David Dratton, and also Marcia Gay Harden as Mrs. Carmody, Andre Brower as the neighbor Norton, and Toby Jones as our steadfast clerk Ollie. And there are actually a million people in this film. Mm. Like if you watch it, you're like, oh, that person's in it. That person, there's like five people in bed in it. It is packed with people. It is very faithful to the novella, with the exception of the ending, which we will discuss the ending, which went way off course. But Stephen King was a fan of the ending. He said it was so anti-Hollywood, anti-everything. It was nihilistic. I like that. And I mean, he's not lying when he says that. But basically, The Mist is about a storm that knocks out all the power and everything in town. And Thomas Jane grabs his son, Billy, to go to the store to get things, to get through the storm. And he and an eclectic group of townspeople end up being stuck in a supermarket because this supernatural mist that's filled with these Lovecraftian creatures starts drifting in. And as you said, Stephen King writes a lot about society and about how this is one of his real skills, I think, and something I enjoy in his stories so much, is how he'll take a group of people and then have them face an extraordinary circumstance, a disaster or something, and see what happens. Like, who takes leadership positions? Mm-hmm. Who sort of steps back and observes? How do these people react in this extraordinary time? And, he did that in Cell and Under the Dome. It's one of his sort of tropes, I guess, now. Mm-hmm. But he does such a great job of it, because the people who end up often taking charge are not the people you want in charge during this situation. Like, evil will often rise to the top, which gets really interesting. So I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on this film. And we will talk about the ending, which scarred me for many years, but now I see it very differently.
I actually quite enjoyed it. It was a first watch for me, the first time watch, and so I knew everything that happened, because it's on all those lists that are like movies that will scar you for life. I know what happens. I've never read the book. I kind of want to go back and read it now, which is kind of the sign of a good adaptation, I guess, isn't it? If you want to go back and read the source material. I actually really enjoyed it from the human point of view. I really enjoyed that it starts off, we've got these two neighbors who have previously had some form of argument, kind of they don't get on for whatever reason, and they are then thrown together into this shop where they are trapped, and it's almost like the root point of the problems within this group of people. I did not care for them showing the creatures. I think that was one of the low points for me.
Now, I was going to ask you about that. Yes.
Now, it was early 2000s. The CGI wasn't the greatest. Maybe that took me out of it a bit. I wouldn't be the biggest fan of like Lovecraftian creatures or Lovecraftian horror, but the things that disturbed me the most was, so during the time there begins to be this fraction, and the people divide into those who are very proactive in trying to figure out how to get out. What are they going to do? They're going to go to the pharmacy. They're going to do this. And then there's another group that is led by this holy roller who is like, the apocalypse have come. Like, this is God cursing us, blah, blah, blah. And she scared the living daylights out of me.
I fully agree with you about the creatures. They are disappointing. There's a scene where a man he's tied to a rope and he goes out to the parking lot and the rope gets caught by a creature. You don't see the creature though. You just see the rope be like lifted up and then his body comes back. That was way more effective than seeing the creatures. And I wish they had done more of that with sort of that Jaws, like what's under the surface, and let us do more imagining on our side of what the creatures might be in the mist. I like it more of a mystery. So I do definitely agree with that. And I fully agree. I love Mrs. Carmody. Like first of all, I know her. And you always ask me, should they redo this? Like, should they adapt it? Should they contemporize? This is a film that would be amazing for them to do now, especially in the United States, with the disruption of the religious right, with all of the conspiracies about the government. I mean, when COVID was out, everyone's like, well, they created COVID to make us sick. And here in this film, the military created these creatures, created this vortex. I think this would be a perfect time for an adaptation. They can't do that ending again. Because unlike you, I had read the novella. And I didn't know what was going to happen. So as I was watching the film, I felt very comfortable that I knew where it was going. I'm like, oh, they're just following the story. Okay, I know how it's going to end. And in the story, the way it ends is they're in a hotel and they're going to get ready to go back into the car. It's still that group of people in the car. And the father's like, I hope we make it out of the mist. I hope we have enough gas. If not, though, there is a gun in the glove compartment. So it just kind of ends, it just kind of trails off. And I thought that's what I was getting. And that's not what I got. And I was livid. I was so angry. The first time I went, and I was like, damn it, I'm never watching this movie again. I was so, I can't explain that. I was just irrationally angry at the ending. I'm glad I went back and watched it again because I will talk about it. I do have a different thought about it now.
Yeah, see, that's how I felt about Dr. Sleep. I was so angry about it. And I still am angry about it. And I've watched it again, and I'm still angry about it. So I don't think I'll ever get over that one. But yes, they're trapped in this store, and the different types of creatures are coming at them from all angles. But it's really the people inside that are the villains. They're the monsters, especially, like you said, this religious right. She manages to like build herself a gathering, and you know, even the ones who initially had taken the piss out of her and been like, well, she's crazy, I think it's William Sadler's character, he then joins in because of what he's seen. He's so scared. And that's the thing. I think at its core, it's saying that scared people do stupid things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot with, like, in society now. Like you said, it would be a perfect, perfect time for it to be redone. Because the people that are giving traction to the alt-right, at their core, they're just scared because they don't understand what's going on. And they're being led astray by these people who say they have the answers, and the answers are, you know, it's the migrants and it's the transgender people and all this, and they're playing on that fear. And that's exactly what the character, I can't remember her name, I'm going to try to find her name.
Mrs. Carmody.
Thank you, Mrs. Carmody. That's exactly what she's doing. She's playing on that fear, and she's literally putting the like fear of God into them. And it culminates in, I think, one of the scariest scenes is when she says they have to sacrifice the little boy. What she calls the whore, who is Laurie Holden's character, Amanda Dunfrey. Mm-hmm. And it's so scary that these group of normal people, like normal community people who before all this got along, now turn and want to sacrifice an innocent child. That scene was just pinnacle for me.
And then, and Thomas Jane's character, I believe it was his character, predicted that early on. He was like, we need to get out of here before she turns on us.
Yeah.
And who's she going to want to sacrifice? Because she keeps talking about blood for the beast, blood for the god. And they did. They threw that soldier out.
Yeah.
You know, they said, it's your fault. Let's feed the beast. And threw him out and left him as a sacrifice. So, you see it building. Yeah. And I fully agree with you. I think these people just wanted, it's almost like I was saying, what's scarier, a creature or a disease or something? Yeah. It's easier to put your anger and fear on something you can latch on to than something that's really abstract.
Yeah.
And so I think they were just looking for an easy, like, okay, if we give it a sacrifice, it'll stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I also found that scene very cathartic, though, because Toby Jones, who is the Ollie Weeks, the supermarket, he just shoots her. He just kills her. And I was like, yes, get it, Toby. You do it.
Yeah, Toby was so good. He was so good that whole movie.
He was so good. I love Toby Jones anyway as an actor. I think he's fantastic. I usually see him as quite a villainous character, but he's so nice in this. He's so good. And, you know, he was just like, I had to do it. Like, I had to do it. And there was no hesitance. It was just like, I had to do it. And I loved that whole scene from beginning to end. Definitely.
It is a big build-up scene. And then you kind of think like, okay, now she's gone. Yeah. Now we can get in the car. We can go. And then it's like, oh, no.
Yeah, so I guess let's talk about the ending, though. So spoiler alert, obviously.
Oh, poor Thomas.
It's so depressing. Like, it's such a depressing ending. So they get into the car and they're driving, and he goes past his house, and his wife is like frozen to death. And
they're all spooned. The people are all spooned. It's horrible.
Yeah. Like, there's lots of spiders and kind of arachnid type insects wrapping people in cocoons, like you said. And so they're driving, and they eventually run out of gas, and, you know, they kind of look at each other, well, like, this is it. There's nothing else left for us. And
for those of us who've been through natural disasters, I've been through nor'easters, hurricanes, everything. Yeah, you do reach that point where you're like, okay, we're out of gas, we're out of heat, we're out of water. What do we do? But we don't have monsters on top of that. That's a whole level.
And they have the gun. And he's counting the bullets, and there's only 4 bullets, but there's 5 of them. And he kind of resigns himself that he's the one that has to kill the rest of them, and then he'll figure something out. And so he shoots them, gets out the car, and he's, you know, trying to get the monsters to come to him. And he hears this roaring that he thinks is a monster. And it turns out it's an army tank with a convoy of tanks that are taking people away to safety, and they're killing all the monsters. And if he had waited seconds, they would have been safe.
It's like the longest Twilight Zone episode ever. It's just like, no.
Just that look of realization on his face.
Oh.
Like, no, it's so depressing.
But like I said, the first time I saw it, I was just livid. And I was like, I'm never watching this movie again. I'm not recommending this film to anybody. You know, I was done. Watching it this time, I thought about the fact that Mrs. Carmody said, if we sacrifice Billy, it ends. And guess what happened? We sacrificed Billy.
Oh, yeah.
And it ended. She was right. God.
That's such a good call. Oh my god. Wow. that depresses me even more, I think, that she was right.
It takes my anger away a little bit for some reason. I think the irony of it, kind of, like the double layer of irony or triple layer of irony, whatever it is, makes me feel a little more like, okay.
Yeah. So why do you think he changed the ending? Do you think he was literally like, I just do not want to give a happy ending for this? Like, I want to mess people up.
Yeah, probably. I think he, I'm trying to think, I've read some interviews and I don't think I've ever read a reason why. Maybe so that people like me who are very familiar with the source material get something, you know, get a shock. twist out of it, get a turn out of it. Maybe he is saying something about this relationship between all of these people in the supermarket and what they know and don't know. And I don't, what do you think? I don't know. I think it was meant to titillate, definitely. I think it was meant to shock.
Yeah. I don't know. I think maybe, I think from, like, I haven't read the original novella, but I think it would have been just too, I don't think it would have suited, like, how dark it gets with the people in the store. If it had just been like, oh, here's a happy ending, I don't think it would have made sense, because, like, life isn't a happy ending, you know? And I think he was right to change it, and I think he was right to do quite a nihilistic ending. Yeah, I think it suited the film a lot more. It's a lot more depressing. But then again, maybe, you know, because he'd done, like, The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, and they end quite nicely. So I was like, maybe he's just kicking back against that. He's like, no, I want to depress everyone even more.
Yeah, well, the original story doesn't necessarily end nicely. It ends with, like, options. Like, either we'll get out of the myth, we'll get eaten by monsters, or we'll have to kill ourselves. And I think it might have been the same scenario, too, with not enough bullets. So you're left sort of with options, but there is that little inkling of hope. Maybe if they just drive far enough, and maybe if they have enough gas to propel them far enough, they will get out of the mist. So there's, like, that little thing to latch on to.
Yeah. No, I like the no hope. it feels real to me that there was no hope, because I feel like after an attack of all these monsters and after everyone going, like, Lord of the Flies on everyone else, I don't think there would be a lot of hope left.
and they set it up. The entire film, Billy is saying, promise me you won't let the monsters get me, promise me you won't let them. But come on, as a parent, this is beyond what you can wrap your head around. It's too much.
It is. One thing I quite liked about it was the little, at the very beginning, the guy is a film poster artist, and one of the posters in there is, I think it's Stephen King's Dark Tower. There's also a poster for The Thing as well, so I quite
there's
liked
Easter eggs the whole way throughout. Like, they're reading Castle Rock newspaper when they're in the supermarket. There's, like, little Easter eggs sprinkled throughout, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I do like those. So would you recommend The Mist to horror fans?
Would I feel I'm sad we I want to say I'm sad we ruined the ending, but as you said, it's been ruined by all of those top 10 horror movies you don't want to watch, you know, that kind of a thing where they tell us what happened. I think it's well done, and I think it's exciting. You know, like you said, take the creatures with a grain of salt. They're a little clunky, a little clunky, but the real horror is the people inside the grocery store and those different factions, and, you know, the townspeople don't like Thomas Jane because they think he's a little uppity, and, you know, they don't like the lawyer either. This is that whole dynamic that we all understand. We've all seen it.
One scene as well that I do want to just mention before we move on is the scene with Melissa McBride. So at the very beginning, when everything has happened, she's like, I've left my kids at home. My 8-year-old is looking after my 3-year-old. I have to get home. Who's going to help me get home? And no one helps her. And so she goes out into the mist. She goes out into the mist. But then at the end, when the convoy of tanks are going by, there she is with her two children, all safe and sound. What did you think of that?
Well, see, that's the thing. When I'm watching it the second time, I didn't remember that that happened.
Yeah.
So when I was watching that scene, of course, as a mother, my heart's going out to her. She's like, I left, you know, the baby with the 8-year-old, and I just for a minute, I thought I'd be gone for a minute. I gotta run out, whatever. I felt for her, and she's begging someone to help her, and no one will make eye contact with her. And she's even how about you? How about you? I'm pointing directly at her. I remember thinking, what's the point of this? What am I supposed to take away from this? But I think it was that setup that she made it.
Mm.
And if Thomas Jane had just, like you said, wait, but he heard the rumbling and thought it was the monsters coming to their car. Mm. He thought it was the monsters, and he promised Billy he wouldn't let the monsters get him.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I felt like she was even another layer of irony of like, see, if you had been paying attention or if you'd gone with her.
Yeah.
If you'd grabbed Billy and said, okay, we'll help you, and gone with her, you guys would have been on that truck again, on that convoy.
Yeah. It really feels like you said, from the original source, it was all about choice. Mm-hmm. You know, what choice could you make and what would be the outcome of it? And it felt like if he had just made another choice, everything would have been okay. It's kind of like that sickening gut punch, isn't it? When you see her drive by and she's like, well. Do you think it's a successful adaptation of?
Yeah, I mean, beyond the creatures, I don't think the creatures are what I was picturing when I read it. Everything lived up to what I had. I enjoyed the novella very much when I read it. And everything that I saw in the film lived up to what I was picturing in my head, which is not common. You know, usually when you read something first and then watch the film, you're like, oh, why did they do that? Why did they, you know, this was really met my expectations. So yeah, I think it was very successful.
Good. I would recommend it even for those that have like never read a Stephen King novel or hasn't read this particular novella. I would recommend it. I think it's very good. And coming from a person who's not really a creature feature fan, I think it's an amazing film. Especially
now, for people who are not familiar with Stephen King, I usually recommend, like you said, Shawshank.
Yeah.
Stand By Me. Green Mile, because they're like, oh my god, is that Stephen King? Oh my god, Stephen King, Shawshank, you know, because most people love those films, but in their mind, that's not what he does. They can't understand that same guy who did Carrie is doing this.
Yeah, exactly. So let's move on then to my choice. So when we were kind of coming up with this, we were trying to stay away from his big ones. We were kind of doing like his more smaller ones. And literally the only one I could think in my head was Gerald's Game.
This is going to be good for us, Jess. Really good.
That's a marriage, isn't it? Working on the difficult things.
For better or worse.
Let's go in. Get comfy.
I bet you think your husband will be back any minute.
Try to call for help.
There's no one for miles.
Gerald?
I'm sorry, baby. You don't get to know my name.
I don't like this. I'm serious. Stop.
I'm like that.
Stop it!
Are you playing?
Is this really what it takes these days?
God, how do we go so wrong? We were happy once, weren't we?
Gerald?
What?
What's happening? Oh. Gerald! Wake up. Just wake up. It's time to wake up, honey.
Which is a 2017 film directed by Mike Flanagan, who also wrote the screenplay with Jeff Howard. It's based on Stephen King's 1992 novel of the same name. And it stars Carla Guigno and Bruce Greenwood, and they are a married couple who have gone away to a lake house. Trying to spice things up, they have marital problems, and he feels that trying to get a bit more kinky might help them. So he persuades her, even though she's very unsure, he persuades her to handcuff herself to the bed. And while they're getting it on, he begins to enact a really horrible rape fantasy. And she's like, not at all. Get the fuck off me. And while he's kind of giving out to her, he ends up having a fatal heart attack. And she is now stuck in these handcuffs. And there's a wild dog that comes in and like eats her husband. and there is a strange shadowy figure, and she's having a lot of hallucinations, and then her past starts coming back to haunt her. So what do you think of Gerald's Game?
Well, this one had a lot of Easter eggs in too. Did you notice when she reaches on the bookshelf, the book is Midnight Mass, which was a Flanagan.
No, I didn't see that one. No.
Flanagan film. And okay, so I read Gerald's Game, I want to say when it came out or shortly after it came out, and was not a fan.
Okay.
Staunchly not a fan of Gerald's Game. But I watched the 2017 Gerald's Game shortly after it came out. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it, because I went in with sort of this, you know, I didn't like the book.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about Mike Flanagan, he always puts Carla in the most beautiful slips and nightgowns you'll ever want to find. Have you watched The Haunting of Hill House?
Yes.
Satin emerald nightgown with matching bathrobe. Every time she appeared, I was like, oh! And then she's in this beautiful satin slip. Like, I'm just like, why can't I be in this film and wear these things? So some of my problems with Gerald, and this is very the film and the book are very close. Like, it's okay. Just very based on the source material. I was a daddy's girl. I was a consummate daddy's girl, and I would still be a daddy's girl if you were still alive. I'm not a fan of how many movies and television shows sexualize that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I know he, molested her, did something. But even her showing up for the eclipse in both the book and the film, she shows up in a sundress with makeup and earrings, like she's on a date with Betty.
Mm-hmm.
Not a fan of this. Not a fan of making that relationship inappropriate from the get-go, but I know this takes it somewhere else, and there's a reason for that. I'm also not a fan, in both the book and the film, I felt like the ending felt very TV movie-ish. Like, it just wrapped up with a little bow, you know, with her sort of, we find out, I don't like that the Moonlight Man had that acromology, whatever it is, he has a disease. When I was reading the book, as you said, it's amazing. Like, they're handcuffed. I mean, there's nothing wrong with couples handcuffing each other. Let's not kink shame, folks. But the problem is his weird rape fantasy. He takes it way too far. So he dies, and you're like, oh my God, she's there. And then it's like, oh, and now there's a man in the room, too. Like, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And I liked not knowing if he was supernatural, if he was real. I like that sort of dancing with that character. Mm-hmm. And then just at the end be like, oh, let's have this big expository line.
Mm.
He actually has a disease, and that's why he looks so weird. And he actually breaks into people's eyes. You know, I sort of felt like it was just too tight of an ending.
Yeah.
And there's no way. I've served on many, many juries. I get called for jury duty every 2 years, like clockwork. Oh my God. So many juries. You cannot just run up and start talking to the guy who they're sentencing. Like, that would never in a million years be allowed to happen. So, but I know they needed her to say, like, you're much smaller than I remember. Like, I get that they needed that line.
Yeah.
But to me, it's sort of like, I really enjoy, like, how's she going to get out of handcuffs? What's that guy going to do? Is he real? Is he not real? And then it just felt like, okay, let's just quickly tell everybody what's going on at the end.
Yeah. It's so another first time watch for me. Obviously, this had a bit of a name for itself when it came out, because everyone was talking about the degloving scene. And so I felt like I'd almost seen it before I'd actually seen it, just because so many people talk about it online. Again, another film like The Mist, where you feel like you've already seen it because of online things. But when I put it on, I felt like their relationship was very, I want to say like strangers, but I don't mean as in a couple that now feel like strangers. It felt like they were actual strangers. Like, she had just gotten married to him. it was very awkward. You know, there's a part where she takes out Kobe beef from the fridge and she feeds it to a stray dog. And she's like, oh my God, I'm sorry, I didn't know. And it just felt like she didn't, she's only been in this marriage for like 5 seconds. And so it didn't feel believable for me. But then, you know, when they're getting down to it and I'm like, oh, he's a gross man. And like, you know, sack him off or whatever. And then he dies. But it just, for me, it didn't have that same impact where, like, if someone dies and you're handcuffed, you'd be like, no. It just felt a bit like she was like, oh, okay. And then this, like, descent into madness. I felt like it teetered on the edge of a lot of things, but it didn't go, like, full on. Like, you know.
A little higher.
Yeah, I guess.
And maybe if their relationship had been more loving, the stakes might have been a little higher, because it might have been interesting to have him die while she's still feeling warmly for him. But then while she's reminiscing, she starts to remember, like, oh yeah, he kind of was a bit of a jerk.
Yeah.
You know, I'm grieving him, but at the same time I'm remembering that he's challenging at times. He could be very misogynistic. He could be very, you know, verbally abusive on top of everything else. And then I felt like the whole, and this is why I didn't really care for the novel. It's this real character arc for her, but I didn't feel really invested in her.
Yeah.
To care about the character arc as much.
Yeah. Even when it starts going into her childhood and like, what happens is absolutely awful. Like, it's really horrible, and how, you know, her father manipulated her into staying silent, and you know, how she now feels like that part of her is in complete darkness, which is represented by the eclipse, and that she can never shine light on that side of her. But I still didn't care. That sounds really bad, because it is such a horrible, you know, a horrible thing for a child to go through. But I think with her development into an adult, it didn't give us enough to care about her. And for me to really gun for her, to be like, yeah, come on, you've got to get out. Like, you know. Yeah,
maybe because she's sort of disassociating everything, because she'd have to be silent. But we can't really latch on to her, because she's a disassociated character. She's kind of ignoring everything.
Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, and then she eventually degloves herself and gets in the car and then crashes. And then, like you said, we get this, like, it's just weird. Like, I texted my friend Carrie afterwards, who's like massive into Stephen King, and I, you know, when it comes to like Stephen King adaptations, I like her opinion as well. And I was like, is the ending a bit weird? She's like, oh, it's completely like just smashed together. And it just seems like, so we see the Shadow Man or something?
Moonlight Man.
And you're like, well, it's probably her mind going a bit crazy. And it's actually, you know, her father and then her husband. And it's just this, like, you know, amalgamation of all these terrible men in her life. And that's what she's seeing, this constant shadow figure that's just looming over her. But then it's like, oh, no, actually, it's a serial killer who, like, would go and steal body parts and also have sex with dead people and then kill people, and had his sister and his brother-in-law in his apartment, and he's actually a real person, and he was there that night. And it just felt so, like, tacked on at the end. Like you said, completely, like, tacked on. I know we get in the very opening scenes when her and her husband are driving in the car and we hear the news report on the radio. But it still doesn't connect it all.
No, they needed a little more, like, them talking about it, or her reading about it on top of it, you know, just a little more. Like, maybe when she went out to feed the dog, he could have even said something like, you know, we need to be careful. They said there's, you know, murders around here. So it just, just like a reminder, or even have her think about that when she saw him. Like, is this that guy?
Yeah.
It felt too sudden at the end. It would have been better had that been just We'd be reminded of that periodically, that there is a real guy out there and what he's doing is horrific. You don't want to come across him at all.
But even like you said, when they're like, oh, he has this condition, I felt like, I mean, I don't know what the source material is like because I haven't read it. I felt like that was really unnecessary. Like, we don't still need to be perpetuating these kind of tropes of like people with kind of physical conditions do not need to be associated with stuff like murder and, you know, necrophiliaism and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I know they wanted to give a reason for his stature, but he could just be a really tall guy.
He's a really tall guy, and the odd features could have been the moonlight. The fact that there's no, you know, when you're looking at someone in the dark and in the shadows, they might look odd because there's no actual light in the room. Yeah, that is how the source material is. It's like, oh, and by the way, he has this. And I was like, oh, okay. what am I supposed to do with that information now?
And I guess that's like a problem I have with Stephen King a little bit, is that he does like to attribute physical ugliness, and this is in air quotation because this is a podcast and people can't see me. He likes to, like, fatness. He likes to equate fatness with badness as well. And it's just, like, I think it's time to kind of do away with that. And yeah, I mean, I don't even have any experience in Irish courts, let alone American courts. But I can guarantee that you can't burst in like that.
You would be arrested yourself. And as I was watching it this time, now when the book was written, it was sort of pre a lot of technology, but she had a phone beside the bed that she couldn't reach. Can't she voice, like, Siri? Can't she do that? And go, Siri, call for help. And then when she's in the car driving, he's a boomer. That was her lawyer boomer husband's car. He would have OnStar. He would have some kind of thing in the car that you could, like, emergency button and get help. Like, it just felt a little like, why are we ignoring that this movie is in 2017 and there's a lot of technology that they could be using?
Yeah, sorry, my cat just, like, opened the door and scared the absolute shit out.
Mine does that all the time too. One time I was watching a thing on the serial killer Richard Ramirez, and she went and busted the door open, like, right in the I hit the ceiling. I absolutely hit the ceiling. I thought it was Richard Ramirez coming to kill me, even though I know he's dead.
Oh my god, cats. That was the problem I had with Gerald's Game, is I was taken out of it too much.
Yeah.
Just by these little, like,
beautiful. She's beautiful to look at.
Yes. Yeah. And
I keep getting caught up in that. Like, oh, I love that clip. I'm watching. I really like it. And there's a really nice cut, a really well done cut. And I keep playing again. I do. There's a really nice cut where the 12-year-old girl, I think it's after the dad manipulates her. Mm-hmm. And that poor actor playing that role, that's a horrible role. Anyway. He, like, throws herself back on the bed with her arms spread, and it cuts to the adult with the arms and the handcuffs. Like, it was a really nice transition. Yeah. So it's a nice film to look at, I think.
Yeah, I'm not a Mike Flanagan fan. I find him too dialogue heavy.
He can be,
But visually, like, the Haunting of Hill House, I think, was absolute stunning visually. And he does a lot of those kind of cuts, a lot of those transitions that are like the one in Haunting of Hill House where Nell is flying through the floors. And when we find out she's the bent neck lady. Like, he's fantastic at those.
So well done.
Yeah, like, I will give him that. But yeah, Gerald's Game, I don't know. Is it a good adaptation? Even though you're not a fan of the source material?
It's faithful to the source material, definitely. And honestly, the things we brought up were a lot of what I was feeling when I was reading the source material. Like I said, it was like, I really don't care if she lived. mean, it sounds horrible, but I really didn't feel any kind of a connection to her. But now I'm wondering if that's because she's so disassociated, because she had to be. She was trained to be disassociated. But again, I have a really hard time getting past the family dynamic. And even the mother sort of like teasing her husband and daughter about like them.
Yeah.
She gets whatever she wants. She just smiles at you. And it just felt to me, and I know that happens in real life. I understand that. I'm not a fan of watching it, that sexualized relationship between a father and daughter and mom knowing fully well that it's happening and just being like, well, what are we going to do?
Yeah. I think maybe I'd have been able to deal with that a bit more if it was brought up, I guess. You know, if she kind of came to terms with that, as in if she was like, you know, mom, it just felt like that was very brushed over. Mm. Very kind of like.
And in the book, he really sets it up like it's the fault of the eclipse.
Mm.
Like the eclipse made the dad crazy, like momentarily lose his mind.
Okay.
And it's super duper strange. Because again, I was a daddy's girl. You could have put a gun to my father's head. He wouldn't have touched me. I don't care what was going on in the world at that time. He would not have touched me.
Yeah.
Eclipse or no. You know, so it felt like, really? Stephen King, you have a daughter. Really?
Yeah.
You know, you're going to write that in there. That's a little...
It's a little weird. Yeah. I mean, we all know Stephen King doesn't like kids in his books. So. They always get the worst of the worst.
Because, you know, I'm a horror writer, and the rules are always like, you know, don't let anything bad happen to kids, no sexual, you know, stuff with kids, no violence with kids, be very, very careful with kids. And he has carte blanche, probably because he makes millions. I don't make the money he makes. He has carte blanche to have anything happen to kids that you want to have happen to kids. It's crazy. Yeah. you don't have happened to kids, you know.
So would you recommend Gerald's Game to horror fans?
If you're like a horror fan and you enjoy, you know, slasher films and you enjoy creature features, you're not gonna like Gerald's Game. It's very psychological, it's very moody. You know, it's more I see more like women who like Lifetime movies enjoying it a little more than horror fans would.
I don't think I would, to be honest. I can't think of who I would recommend it to. I wouldn't recommend it.
I will recommend a Stephen King adaptation that a lot of people miss. It's a neglected one, and that's The Good Marriage.
Okay.
It is about a couple that they've been together 30-some years, and she realizes her husband he's basically the BTK killer. He has been kidnapping, torturing, raping, murdering women their entire marriage. It is a smart, unlike this one, you do care. It's smart. It's clever. It's well done. The story, it's based on a short story, which is also very, very good. Like, Stephen King does a great job of, you know, all those emotions you would feel. Yeah. You found out that your spouse was this other person and had been the whole time, and you were unaware of it, and now you're aware of it, and what do you do with that information? But it's really well done. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we'll save that. Maybe even I'll save that if we do another Stephen King.
Yeah,
we'll do that one because it's good. Maybe it's exciting. Good.
Definitely. So out of the two films, I know the answer to this one, obviously. But out of the two films, which one would you recommend over the other?
Yeah, The Mist. I think you'll get more bang for your buck out of The Mist. Yeah,
definitely. So what Stephen King material would you like to see adapted or readapted?
That's a really good question. He's done so many of them. You know, I was a big fan of Under the Dome, the book. I know a lot of people did not like it. I enjoyed it. The TV show was horrific. It was painful. It was a tragedy. So maybe they could do that one and do it well. Like, if they really just stuck to the book, they went off on all kinds of weird tangents and it was just awful. Like, the first half hour of the TV show was good because they stayed with the book and it was good. And then they went way off and it was just painful. That one, that would be a good one if they could really do it well. I think it could be nicely done. And again, I think it would be very timely with, you know, because they're under the dome going like, well, where's the government? Why aren't they helping us? Why aren't they coming to get us? Which, again, as someone who survived a hurricane, let me tell you, spoiler alert, they don't come. They do not. They say they do. And on the news, they say FEMA's there and FEMA's doing stuff. And guess what? They're not. Nobody's there. Nobody's helping you. You are left on your own. So they could really do a lot with that. And again, with that, it's that perfect, like, microcosm of society, the people who are stuck under the dome. Who takes charge? Who, you know, like you said, who's making plans and who's kind of going off the rails?
Yeah.
So I think maybe I would vote for that one. What about you? Do you have one that you would like to see?
I'd like to see a redo of Dr. Sleep. I'm interested.
I'm a fan of the book. I was disappointed in Dr. Sleep, the book. I did not want Danny, after all he'd been through in The Shining, to become an addict. And to, I didn't want that for him. I was really disappointed in that character development.
I think... I thought it was an interesting portrayal on kind of the after effects of trauma, as well as, like, you know, the cyclical nature of stuff like addiction and how it is something that, you know, is kind of inherited a lot. And I liked the way he found his family. Like, he's always been searching for family and he found it. I don't like the way that in the film, spoiler alert, they kill him. Like, I thought that was ridiculous. I didn't like the changes that they made. It just made me really, really angry. I liked the book, but the film, it just annoys me. It's too many changes. I'm interested in the Salem's Lot. The new Salem's Lot that's meant to be coming out, although it's meant to be coming out for like the past 3 years, I think. That would be interesting.
It could be good. It could be bad. I like the book. I like Salem's Lot, the book.
Yeah, same. And also, there's a Pet Sematary prequel coming out, isn't there? I wish they'd leave that alone.
Yeah, it's enough.
Yeah.
The first Pet Sematary was very good. Like, that terrorized a whole generation of people. The original Pet Sematary movie, people freaked out over that movie. Just leave it be, it's fine.
Yeah, it's grand. So yeah, that would be my... See, I'm not really well versed in a lot of Stephen King stuff, apart from he's like most well known. So, but I'm gonna try and remedy that, and I think I'm gonna start with The Mist.
Okay.
Yeah. Now,
I have a question for you.
Oh, go for it.
So, you know, I watch a different horror movie every day for Halloween month. That's always my gig. Yeah. This year, I'm only doing movies from 2023. I know you liked Evil Dead. I know some of the movies you've enjoyed this year. But I wanted to know if there might be one that might be a little eclectic, I might not have thought of, from 2023, a horror film for me to watch in October.
So... for anyone that will sit down and listen to me.
Got my pen and paper ready. Go ahead.
There is a film. I think it's coming out on streaming October the 27th. So it's going to be quite late in your Halloween.
That's fine.
It is called When Evil Lurks.
Okay.
And it is by Damien Rugner, who did Terrified or Aterrado. And he did a segment in Satanic, oh god, what is that film called? No, it'll come back to me. But yes, When Evil Lurks, it's like my top two films of this year that I've seen. Satanic Hispanic, sorry, was that film that I was thinking of. Yes, When Evil Lurks, it is dark, it is fresh, I think a fresh take on the possession genre. And I just, anyone that's been listening to me, I've been like, please, please watch this when it comes out. I love it. Absolutely love it. Yeah, that would be. And also, I think it's coming out very soon. The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster is a take on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And it's fantastic. I think it's one of the, like, a really good adaptation of it.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, no, these were not on my original list, so that's awesome. That's just what I needed. Thank you.
There you go. There's my recommendations.
I appreciate it.
Okay, so if people would like to find you on social media, where can they do so?
Oh, I'm all over the place. I'm on TikTok with all you youngins, and I am Elaine Pascal on TikTok and Facebook. I'm at Doc Laney, DocLaney on Twitter. I mean, X, whatever the heck it is now.
I still call it Twitter.
Instagram. I know. I'm so irritated with that. And on Instagram as well. And I have a YouTube channel where I do the Lady of Horror readings, and that is also Elaine Pascal.
That was my chat there with Elaine Pascal about two Stephen King adaptations. We chatted about The Mist from 2007, as well as Gerald's Game from 2017. So let me know, what did you think of these adaptations? Do you think they are good adaptations of Stephen King stories? Let us know on social media, Twitter at @what_scream, Instagram @whatascream, Letterboxd as well. And don't forget to rate, review, subscribe on whatever platform you are listening to this podcast on. It is greatly appreciated. Next week, I am going to be talking about a really cool subject. I'm going to be talking about heavy metal in horror with my special guest, Brad Hansen. We talk about one really good film, one utterly ridiculous film. So tune in next week to find out what they are and listen to our discussion about metal in horror. And don't forget to stay horrific. Goodbye.